the coming week, Americans mark 20 years since the 9/11 terrorist attacks. A summit of Asian powers discusses security in Afghanistan, and Norway holds general elections. It's September 9th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, this weekend, Americans and the world in various ways is going to mark the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks. President Biden on Saturday is set to visit the three sites where hijacked planes crashed on September 11, 2001 to commemorate the victims as well as those who performed heroically that day. It's very hard, even though I've been marking this anniversary now for months, it feels like. It's hard to believe 20 years have gone by. But with everything happening both in the United States, Afghanistan, and it feels like everywhere, how do you set the scene for us on this anniversary?
Well, Bob, the word I would use to describe the anniversary is one you've already used, and that's somber. And I think it's a somber anniversary for two reasons. One is the day itself. For the roughly one-third of Americans who were either too young to remember 9/11 or who had not yet been born, it's probably impossible to understand how much changed that day. And for those of us who lived through it, it's probably impossible to forget the befuddlement, the horror, and the fear that we felt, not only on that day, but for the weeks and months that followed. You know, we often refer to numbers on our podcast, Bob, but I don't think numbers begin to capture the enormity of the attacks. Nearly 3,000 people died in less than an hour in the deadliest terrorist attack in world history. Most of those who died were Americans, but several hundred were foreign citizens. Thousands of people were injured, some grievously. It's estimated that some 3,000 children lost a parent on 9/11. Many of the first responders who heroically rushed to the scene, especially at the site of the World Trade Center, subsequently contracted debilitating or fatal diseases from being exposed to all the contaminants in the air. Economists tell us that the direct cost of the attacks topped $100 billion. When you consider the broader impact on the economy, the cost may have topped $1 trillion. And that's not counting the costs, both human and financial, of the wars that 9/11 triggered. But again, there's another reason why I think the 20th anniversary of 9/11 is a somber one, and that is the overriding sense that American foreign policy lost its way in the two decades after that attack. As you know, Bob, many retrospectives are being published this week, and I would describe them all as decidedly negative. One in particular I would flag comes from Michael Hirsch at foreignpolicy.com, and its title captures everything: How the U.S. Got 9/11 Wrong. And you look back over the last two decades, the invasion of Afghanistan turned into a prolonged occupation, and we've seen recently the cost of the withdrawal. 9/11, I think, made possible the invasion of Iraq. Terrorism that we had thought was confined to Afghanistan has metastasized across the world. We've talked almost endlessly about its impact across the Middle East, North Africa, increasingly in Central and Southern Africa, and other places as well. And I guess I just come back to this anniversary in particular, and I can't help escape a great feeling of sadness that we suffered a catastrophic day, and that in our response to it, in many ways, we made the problem worse rather than better. And I get a sense that, you know, our horror became a hubris, which has become a humbling. And we're left with the most aching of all questions: what might have been if we had made different choices?
Jim, I really couldn't add anything to the way you've summed it up, thinking back on the trajectory of 20 years, both as an American, as a journalist, as someone attached to a foreign policy think tank, and all the ways we've examined this inside and out. It's hard not to just be tinged with both the sadness, frustration, and sometimes exasperation. I do recall my own experience, Jim, being at the time a correspondent for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty at the United Nations. The feeling of, I guess, community initially, and by community, I use the term international community, which I know is a term that a lot of people don't like. But covering the UN, I had a pretty interesting perch. There were people at the UN aghast as anyone else. They were quick to point out the international nature of the victims as well as the impact. And yet, the UN was also a place where you had sort of the pursuit of what eventually became the U.S. invasion of Iraq play out. And it was a place where there was pushback against the U.S. at the time. And I remember just sort of feeling, you know, 2 years after the fact, that it was the beginning of an increasingly dark period. It wasn't a period of the international community, actually. It was going to be a period of division. And sort of here we are, you know, we're continuing to count the lessons learned. And it feels like the lessons have not been learned in the ways that they should have been. And we're also coping with the pandemic on top of everything else, which in some ways has sharpened, you know, the feelings of community as opposed to bringing people together.
I think you're quite right, Bob, to highlight the outpouring of sympathy and support across the globe for the United States in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. People around the world were horrified by what they had witnessed. And the support didn't come just from America's friends, partners, and allies. It came from countries that had hostile relations with the United States, because everybody understood that these attacks really threatened the core foundation of modern society. And again, even looking just at our friends, partners, and allies, NATO famously invoked its Article 5, the Collective Defense Clause, for the first time in its history. Countries followed the United States into Afghanistan to go after Osama bin Laden. And I think in, you know, the fall of 2001, going into the spring of 2002, the United States enjoyed tremendous support around the world. And it's that sort of comparison between where we were, let's say, 6 months after the attacks and where we are now that I think is so stark and has really led to this real somber note, the sense that we failed ourselves in our policies. And I will note that when you look at what has happened over the last 20 years, the over-militarization of U.S. foreign policy, that was something that people at the time warned about, because people who were old enough who had lived through Vietnam were worried about the same sort of set of decisions, that we would rely too heavily on military instruments and neglect the full toolbox of foreign policy options we had to deal with it. And I think not just now, but for decades to come, people are going to be writing very critical pieces about how the United States responded to 9/11. I want to be clear here. This is not to critique the tremendous heroism of American servicemen and women and the sacrifices they made. And again, when you think of it, you know, after 9/11, the outpouring of patriotism, young men, young women joining the military, understanding that they were very likely to go into combat, is a testament to their courage and their patriotism. So I'm no way trying to gainsay any of that. But I think that historians are not going to treat this period in American foreign policy very well. And indeed, I think if you look at the public opinion polls and you look at many of our divisions in the country, many Americans here and now aren't really happy with the choices we made, even though I will note that at the time, many of the choices we made enjoyed a tremendous degree of political support. And that, of course, was true back in Vietnam as well in the early days.
Yeah. And the summer's events in Afghanistan were kind of a prep for a lot of this reflection that we're undergoing this week, especially this weekend and the weeks ahead, Jim, in terms of what transpired in Afghanistan, what was done wrong, why we were there so long. I think, as we've discussed previously in recent podcasts, Jim, there's a little bit of irony in the divisiveness over the Biden administration's plan to pull out so abruptly, because it was something that President Trump wanted to do very much and wanted to do before the end of his term, actually. And I think that touches on a sentiment that Americans have kind of had it with the so-called forever wars. And there's deep concern about how long they've lasted, how long the U.S. is supposed to be committed to nation-building projects and all of that. But again, if we see, you know, the Afghanistan debate, it does get back to your point about the militarization that, you know, Americans are going to deploy and they're going to fix things that are broken. And it was especially sad with the last victims of the Afghan war, the 13 service members who were killed in the terror explosion at Kabul airport. Many of them were barely alive when the 9/11 attacks occurred. They were so young and had been involved in basically a mission to help people get out of Afghanistan and paid with their lives. So again, there's a lot of memories, as you say, somber, and hopefully something that a generation of Americans growing up now will take heed of and kind of use to guide future policies.
On that point, Bob, I will note that roughly 1 out of 3 Americans living today either were too young to remember 9/11 or were not yet born. And so I think we need to keep this in mind as we talk about 9/11. For some of us, it's something that we felt and experienced, particularly people who were in New York City or in Washington, D.C. on 9/11. But for many Americans, this is something that's in the history book, which is why I think we very actively have to learn about what happened. On this score, I'll just note there are a number of great websites that explore 9/11. There are a number of online exhibits that museums have put together so people can sort of honor and learn more about 9/11. On my blog, The Water's Edge, I posted links to a number of these exhibits. I really do encourage people to check them out. This is just a wealth of great knowledge, experience. Some of it, obviously, is just very haunting and very painful to see, but I think it's important so that we all understand what transpired. My great fear, though, Bob, is even though everyone right now is saying we will never repeat these mistakes, I'm old enough to remember the end of the Vietnam War when people said definitively there's no way Americans will repeat the mistakes of Vietnam. And that's why it comes back to a point I'll often make. I really encourage people to learn a lot about history. The world wasn't born yesterday. We have a longer span of time of things we can witness and lessons we can learn. Not saying history repeats, but to a surprising degree, it rhymes. And sometimes if you look at American foreign policy, we get more cocky about what we're capable of achieving than what events warrant. That is not a case for retreat. It's not making the case for withdrawal. It's making the case for hard-headed, clear-eyed analysis of the situations we face.
Yeah, and let me just reinforce, you mentioned your blog post, Jim. You have a nice series, actually, of places to go to for books, podcasts, even a rundown on the biggest conspiracy theory hoaxes. I think I recommend everybody take a look at that. And to your point also about the many good sources there are some terrific documentaries. If documentaries are your thing, there's a number that Frontline has done. I'm still kind of riveted by one of the ones that came out just a few years after the 9/11 attacks, where there was a French film crew that was following a U.S. fire department the day that the attacks occurred, just for kind of a visceral look at what those attacks actually meant. But then for all the other legacy things, there's so many good sources. And there continue to be books written on the Vietnam War, for that matter, and to your point, and a lot of great resources on that. Again, we can't say it enough. Read the history to help avoiding to repeat it.
Just a quick addendum there, Bob. I have a post going up today which lists a number of documentaries that have been done about 9/11. I'll have to confess, I haven't been able to keep up with them all because there has been a flood of documentaries released just in the past week by a variety of news and media outlets. But at least we'll try to, in the post, grab at least some of the major ones that have been put before the public.
I look forward to seeing that, Jim.
Bob, let's change topics and turn our attention to the upcoming Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit, where Afghanistan will be among the issues topping the agenda. Now, the meeting starts next week, and it brings together officials from China, Russia, and India, among others. Tell us what we need to know going into the summit.
Jim, it's been a while, actually, since we've talked about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit. I think we even, in the past, got some listener mail to the effect of, what are you doing talking about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit? It's fictitious, and so forth. It has been, for many years, it's almost 20 years old, a bit of a talking shop and a Russia-China vehicle for attempting to counter U.S. influence in South Asia. I think it has a lot more relevance in light of the current developments in Afghanistan and the region. I think this meeting coming up in Tajikistan is going to be an interesting one to watch. Among other things, you now have, as part of the full members of the organization, India and Pakistan. You still have, as an observer, Iran. So you have almost every country bordering Afghanistan is represented in some way, and every power broker in the region represented. They are going to be sort of talking, frankly, I think, about how to regard the Taliban now, the Taliban leadership, and what it means for regional security. This organization is essentially a security one. China has tried to introduce some economic elements to it that Russia, among other countries, has resisted. But they all are agreed that they should continue talks and occasionally plan some exercises, which they have done through the years, in terms of being counter-terrorism ready in the event that the Taliban, you know, goes back to its previous guise from 20 plus years ago and becomes kind of an exporter of extremism. We had some comments from China's foreign minister, Wang Yi, this week, calling on the Taliban to, quote, unite all ethnic groups and factions, build a broad and inclusive political structure, pursue a moderate and prudent domestic and foreign policy, and draw a clear line with terrorist forces, as well as establish and develop friendly relations with countries, especially neighboring countries, end quote. I think there's a great deal of skepticism, probably in Beijing as well, since those comments were made, given the cabinet that the Taliban agreed on, at least an interim cabinet, made up of what looks to be hardcore Taliban members. The interior minister, for example, is the head of the Haqqani network, the kind of notorious Haqqani network.
He has a bounty on his head for, I think it's $5 million.
I've seen some estimates, almost half of the cabinet has a bounty or has some sort of sanctions on them for various abuses, if not outright.
Well, this is for carrying out terrorist attacks against U.S. troops and against Afghan civilians.
Yeah. And also steps like abolishing the Women's Affairs Ministry and reinstating a Vice and Virtue Ministry. We've seen this picture before. war with the Taliban. So I think there's a great deal of concern about what in fact is going to happen to Afghanistan, at least in the near term. And so I think you'll have this group of, you know, regional leaders talking frankly about it and what it's going to mean. I think you're going to have a bit of friction now with the India-Pakistan development. India's signaled it's going to raise the concern about terrorism supported by Pakistan, which was, as we've discussed before, a base for the Taliban for years as it was mounting its insurrection against the U.S.-led forces in Afghanistan. So we're looking at a Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit that might be turning a few more heads than previous ones, Jim.
Bob, have we seen any early actions in Beijing or in Moscow or in Delhi in terms of the response to the formation of the new Taliban government? As we talked before, all of these governments have reasons to be concerned about the consequences for themselves of the Taliban takeover.
Yeah, I think it's being watched very closely following the initial sort of, as we discussed, the schadenfreude in China and Russia in particular, after the manner of the U.S. departure after 20 years or so in Afghanistan. There is a bit of realism mingled with some pragmatism, perhaps, on the part of at least Russia and China, as we've seen it in the UN Security Council, for example, where the discussions about how to regard the new regime and whether or not it should get recognition. We should note the previous Taliban regime, it held power from 1996 to 2001, Jim, held sway over about 80 to 85% of the country by many estimates. And yet it was never recognized as the official Afghan government entity. It was a Northern Alliance, which was this force that held out the Panjshir Valley in the north, mainly ethnic Tajiks were part of it. That was the recognized UN seat for Afghanistan. And so you'd have these meetings playing out in the Security Council, and you'd have this group representing a fragment of the country speaking on behalf of Afghanistan. First of all, the Northern Alliance doesn't exist anymore. Panjshir Valley has fallen to the Taliban by most accounts.
At least for now.
At least for now. And you have Russia and China now saying, let's not be too hasty on either recognizing the Taliban, but also on condemning them. Let's hold back, because the U.S., I think, has been more interested in signaling that the UN Security Council was going to be watching very closely and ready to punish a Taliban regime that took steps that were seen as, you know, basic violations of human rights and so on. So that's sort of the early signaling in the UN Security Council. These are two countries that have maintained contacts with the Taliban, have said things like I just quoted Wang Yi, which is opening the door towards friendlier relations. So we'll have to see, Jim, but it could be a new ballgame. But again, given who we now see constituting the interim Taliban government, we should not be kidding ourselves that this is a regime that could head down this sort of extremist path once again, and by that also become a haven for groups that would be seen as a threat to Russia and China in particular.
One positive note that I should flag, Bob, is that as of today, flights going in and out of Kabul's international airport have resumed, and some Americans and Westerners who did not get out before the end of the American withdrawal apparently have been on those planes and are leaving. So that's a positive sign. I think the one thing we need to keep an eye on going forward is what is happening to the money that has been going into Afghanistan. Are we going to see international organizations and individual countries continue with the freeze many of them put on sending money to Afghanistan? That's the main lever they have in dealing with the Taliban and trying to extract concessions. At some point, I would imagine they're going to have to let up on that lever, or it's going to lose its effect because the Taliban is going to lose hope that they're going to get those funds at all. So that's a delicate diplomatic dance to be negotiated, particularly given that the longer the freeze on assets and money flows goes on, the worse off many individual Afghanis are going to be. And as we discussed before, some very tough policy challenges for a number of countries.
Yeah, and along with that, Jim, a separate but related set of developments is to what extent does the UN get involved in Afghanistan more deeply in terms of just dealing with the crisis sort of triage elements, you know, feeding people, dealing with COVID outbreaks and so forth, or does the UN rein it in because it's so disturbed by what it's seeing happen on the ground? That's going to be another element worth watching. And again, it'll come back in some ways to the Security Council.
And just adding in, we are now about to enter fall, which means much colder weather, much greater hardship for the people of Afghanistan.
Jim, I want to take our conversation now over to Norway, of all places, because Norway is going to vote in a general election for its full 169-member parliament. There are indications that the Prime Minister, Erna Solberg, who is running for a third term, may be on her way out along with her coalition government. Some polling is showing Jonas Gahr Støre, I hope I pronounced that correct, is the election's frontrunner, and that his Labour Party will likely form a new center-left government. Jim, can you give us some background on this election?
I'm pleased to do so, Bob, especially given that one of our followers on Twitter, Espen, asked that we discuss the Norwegian parliamentary election. elections. He tweeted at me that the elections are undercovered internationally, and he was hoping we could say something about them. I'm more than happy to do so, both because we like to be responsive to our listeners and because the election highlights debates we're seeing in many advanced industrialized economies, including the United States. But first, let's do sort of a primer on Norwegian politics. As you mentioned, it's parliament. The Storting has 169 seats, so you need 85 to get to be in the majority. Now, Norway has a population of roughly 4.4 million people and 19 political parties. As you point out, the current coalition government is a center-right coalition led by the Conservative Party. And if you believe the opinion polls, the opposition Labour Party is on the path to become the next leader of what will almost certainly be another coalition government. All of the projections suggest that the Labour Party is going to need at least two other political parties to be able to form a majority government. What's really interesting following Norway's election debate are the two issues that are dominating in the conversation. One is climate change, the other is the widening wealth gap. Now, on climate change, my sense is that the debate in Norway has been fueled by the release last month of the UN report warning that climate change and its consequences are accelerating. And this debate is highlighting a real split or conflict within Norway. And on the one hand, you have individual Norwegians who are incredibly environmentally conscious. 60% of new cars sold in Norway are electric vehicles. That compares with just 2% in the United States. Norway generates 98% of its electricity through renewables, mainly hydroelectric power. I think the number in the United States is somewhere in the teens. So Norway, on the one hand, is an environmentally conscious country. On the other hand, Norway is the world's 14th largest oil exporter. It is a country that has gotten wealthy off the commodity that is generating the climate change problem. And this highlights the political tension that we've seen elsewhere and we've discussed before. That is, people want to transition away from oil. However, doing so is going to cost the jobs that depend upon the production of oil. And that's politically very difficult. And so whoever wins in Norway, and let's assume the polls play out, yes, the Norwegian government is likely to do more to ramp up the cuts in the emission of heat-trapping gases, but that's likely to be gradual. And as we discussed before, Bob, it's not clear that we have the time for more gradualism. The other big issue in Norway, as I mentioned, is growing inequality. Norway is a country in which egalitarianism is a deeply entrenched value. And the fact that Norway is debating income inequality may strike Americans as odd because if you compare Norway to the United States, Norway is incredibly egalitarian. Just give you a couple of statistics. If you look at something called the Gini Index, it's a way of sort of measuring inequality, and it runs from 0 to 100. 0 meaning income is shared equally across society, and 100 means one person gets everything. You know, in Norway, the number would be about 26.8. In the United States, it'd be about 47. Or looking at it somewhat differently, if you were to rank countries by inequality, the United States is the 51st most unequal country in the world. Norway's 149th. But again, in the context of Norwegian politics, people are noticing that income inequality is deepening. There's a growing number of children living in low-income households. And just as important, people are seeing housing prices rise faster than salaries. So these are very big issues that Norwegians are grappling with. And again, they're the same issues we see happening in other countries. In the United States, these are big issues, and we're seeing across Western Europe and elsewhere.
It is fascinating, especially the environmental aspect that you touched on. And it could be, as we enter into what looks like an incredibly busy election season this fall, you know, Norway, you know, indicates a trend or not, because you're going to have later this month German elections where the German Greens are really powerful. Even if they don't come up to what some of their polling was showing earlier this year, they're still a highly effective, organized bloc in that country. And you have others, again, as I said, taking place through the end of the year.
Well, on that point, Bob, if I may, just note that our friends in the north, the Canadians, are going to be having an election election, I think it's on the 20th. And climate change is going to be an issue there because in Canadian politics, there are divisions between those who want to rein in carbon emissions and those, particularly in the western provinces, Alberta stands out, that depend a lot on the ability to extract fossil fuels from the ground.
Yes, Jim, that's a good point to raise Canada as well. And there's others certainly that are going to be affected by the debate one way or another this year. Back to your original reference to the IPCC report, it really is a test on whether that report and it really laying out in stark terms, you know, what the world is facing, whether it actually moves people to change the calculus in elections, and whether that, as well as the real-time events happening, the scorching temperatures in many places this summer, you know, wildfires, but also the flooding. We just had a Hurricane Ida that also had, you know, incredible damage, not only in the Gulf in the United States, but in the Northeast, and almost 50 deaths registered in Northeastern United States, and on, is that going to have an effect on people's attitudes going to the polls where they could elect candidates who are saying, we are going green, we are going to go alternative, we are going to stop fossil fuels and so forth. It's not clear. It's certainly not clear in the United States still.
Agreed. And I suspect that in many of these countries, we are not going to see the very significant changes we need being enacted over the timeline they must be. But let's move on before I thoroughly depress myself, Bob, and discuss our audience figure of the week. Of course, listeners can vote on or tweet us their suggestions for audience figure of the week at CFR_org. This week, our audience selected Bolsonaro against courts as the figure of the week. Why is President Bolsonaro in the news, Bob?
Jim, President Jair Bolsonaro is in the news because he is taking on his country's Supreme Court. Now, he has been claiming repeatedly that the court has exceeded its constitutional limits. It needs to be reined in. He, in particular, has singled out one justice, Alexandre de Moray, be removed and has asked for his impeachment. De Moray is overseeing an investigation that actually is targeting the president and two of his sons. And so, in the midst of all this, Bolsonaro has decided to call on his base. And just this past Tuesday, was able to have a number of protest rallies take place in major cities in the country, bringing that up. There were fears that this could spill over into violence and that Brazil's institutions, which have held fairly strong through a lot of the challenges that have come up recently, could start to weaken. That did not happen, and the institutional strength appears to be there. But there's a lot of concern that Bolsonaro, who has increasingly sort of drawn doubts about next year's elections, Brazil will hold general elections in about a little bit more than a year from now, that those elections are already sort of damning them as faulty, that the country has electoral failings, and that he has
a plan.
That sounds
familiar, Bob.
There's a reason why Bolsonaro is called the Trump of the tropics, and so we'll have to see how much his playbook resembles the Trump playbook in this final year. It should also be noted, despite the passion of his base, is extremely unpopular according to many opinion surveys. The country's handling of COVID is seen to be a debacle, for want of a better term. It's got the second highest rate of mortality, I believe, after the United States in the world, more than 500,000 people dead at this point, fairly unchecked in a number of places in the country. There's problems of inflation, and there's the figure of Lula da Silva looming on the horizon as a potential candidate who could generate the base on the leftist side of the country in a way that could really deliver a decisive defeat of Bolsonaro. So he is trying to prepare the way to create doubt and concern about that prospect.
So how have Bolsonaro's critics responded to his claims about impending election fraud? I believe Bolsonaro has been arguing that everything should be by a paper ballot because of his claims about election rigging and the like, but that seems to be more posturing rather than based on any real concern about the security of Brazilian elections.
That's right. And they're trying to push back and trying to use the country's various institutions, electoral oversight boards, and so forth, to thwart any moves by Bolsonaro to change the way elections are run. We should note at latest report, there were planned protests led by Bolsonaro opponents on September 12th. So this coming Sunday, Jim, they're going to be sort of seeing what kind of turnout those get. And maybe you'll start seeing these kind of competitions for crowd size playing out in what looks to be a pretty tumultuous final year heading into Brazil's elections. Again, we should note Brazil's institutions, Brazil's military have hewed to a mostly democratic path at this point, but you have a figure leading the country who's a great deal of power, who has a motivated base. And so there is concern about how Brazil handles things in the period ahead.
I'm curious, Bob, with the Biden administration and Joe Biden's talk about defending democracy around the world, has the Biden administration taken a position on what's happening in Brazil? Have we heard President Biden speak out in one way or the other? Or is he keeping mum for the time being?
From what I've seen, I haven't seen in detail what the administration's been saying on this particular set of developments in Brazil, Jim. But in general, they have been trying to maintain a consistent voice about supporting democratic norms, not trying to be sort of intrusive in Brazilian affairs, certainly, because I think the U.S. would still like to see Brazil as a partner in some hemispheric matters. But at the same time, still trying to show that there is a democratic middle line that Brazil needs to hew to. And so I think they're kind of biding their time before and if they have to say anything stronger at this point. At a time when in the region, democracy is in a tough space, let's look no farther than Mexico. And the administration obviously has a lot of things it has to deal with on the Mexican front. It's not going to chastise Mexican democracy as of yet.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that the Biden administration has yet nominated someone to be ambassador to Brazil. They may have. I just haven't seen any news about that.
So, Jim, in reviewing sort of the rate of ambassador appointments, I did not see Brazil on the most recent list of nominees. Now, there have been some reporting that there's a number of vacancies throughout Latin America and the Caribbean, and Brazil appears to be one of them still, Jim. So quite significant.
Oh, certainly, Bob, given that Brazil is the most populous country in Latin America with a population of 211 million or more, and given the prominence of climate change as an issue because of the future of the Amazon, which many people described as the lungs of the world, and they are being damaged at a very high clip.
No, a hugely important country in the region, hugely important to have, you know, someone on the ground there leading a policy and a day-to-day engagement. So yeah, we'll keep an eye on Brazil.
That we will do.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The UN General Assembly kicks off its annual session in New York, and the annual Thessaloniki International Trade Fair takes place.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long, and please stay healthy out there.